From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 29th day of July 2010. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll take a complete look at the agricultural futures markets with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group. He's out of Decatur, Illinois. Later in the program, we'll get an update on the agricultural news for the afternoon, including a push to have EPA mandate E12 rather than E15 as a temporary measure, even if E15 were to come into play later this fall. And then in the second half of our program, we call that The Farming World, and it's available on many of these radio stations, always online at willag.org. We'll talk with Steve Long. He's a professor of crop sciences here at the U of I, about the soy face experiments, looking at carbon dioxide increases and the impact on agricultural production. It all happens on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
In Chicago, on this Thursday afternoon, futures finished like this. The nearby September wheat, 627.5, up 12. December, 659.5, 12.5 higher. And the March wheat at $6.83, up 12.25. And July of next year at $6.88¾, up 10¼. Hard red from Kansas City, a $6.46¼ settlement price, up 15.5 cents. Corn pit now, September futures, $3.79¼ in Chicago, up 3. December, $3.93¾, 3 higher. March at $4.06¼, up 3 in the May at $4.14, 2.5 higher. July at $4.20¾, up 2¼. December of next year, 2011 contract, $4.25½, a penny and 3/4 higher. August soybeans, $10.26¾, up 16¼. September at $9.92¾, up 7¾. November at $9.88, a dime higher. January beans, $9.95½, up 8¾. And the March at $9.98¼, up 7½ cents on the day. September oats at $2.61½, up 4½. August meal at $3.05.40, up 3.70. August oil at $39.27 for the bean oil, up 43 on the afternoon. CME Group August live cattle at $91.85, 92½ lower. August feeders at $113.70, 2½ down 80 cents on the day. The September's there at $114.27½, 57½ lower. And the August lean hog futures, $84.85 a hundredweight, finished $1.47½ higher. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures, nearby contract, September, $78.48 a barrel, rather $78.40 a barrel, up $1.41. Ethanol at $1.66¾, 2½ cents higher. Natural gas at $4.83¾, up 11¼. Heating oil or diesel fuel at $2.04 even, 4¼ higher. And the gold futures at $1,168.40 an ounce, the settlement price up $8 for the day. The Dow Jones Industrial Average now stands at 10,503. That's just about 5 points higher. The dollar at 81.64 is down 0.53, and the CRB index at 270.20 is 4.04 higher. The Goldman Sachs at 518.42 is up 8.43 on the afternoon. The weather forecast looks like this for the day. Says the skies should be mostly sunny here in Urbana-Champaign. High near 85, north to northeast winds around 8 miles an hour. Tonight, partly cloudy. Low around 60, north winds around 5 miles an hour, becoming to the east. And then tomorrow, partly sunny on Friday, a high near 83, east winds at 7 miles an hour. Friday night, a 40% chance of showers, a few thunderstorms. That'll come after 1 o'clock in the morning, mostly cloudy. A low around 64, southeast winds between 6 and 9 miles an hour. Saturday, a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy, a high near 86, south winds at 5 to 8 miles an hour. And then Saturday night, partly cloudy, a low of 66. Sunday, mostly sunny, high near 85. We'll wrap out the weekend with a low of 69 and partly cloudy skies. A complete look at the agricultural weather forecast for the Midwest, the nation, and the globe when we return at the bottom of the hour and talk with agricultural meteorologist Pete Levitt right here on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
The Closing Market Report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from L&M Commodities, a full-service brokerage company serving area farmers with professional market advice and crop insurance products. L&M Commodities has offices in New Market, Indiana, Leland, Illinois, and Terrell, Arkansas.
You're listening to the CMR from Illinois Public Media. On the phone line with us today to take a look at the agricultural futures markets, Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group out of Decatur, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Dan.
Good afternoon.
It's kind of an interesting sort of day in Chicago and has been a couple of interesting weeks, maybe a couple of interesting months. Are you feeling more bullish than bearish at this point?
I've pretty well stayed with my biases to the upside. Price action, you know, started turning more friendly there in early June, and it has kind of continually improved over time here. And now, you know, it appears now that the fundamentals for some of that early technical bullishness is being realized, and of course that's the purpose of technical analysis, is to get ahead of the fundamentals. And we're now seeing, you know, basically crop conditions here in the United States, they're not getting any bigger, and I think there's some in the trade with some of the weather forecasts are beginning to suggest that maybe the corn and soybean crops are shrinking a little bit in here with the current weather pattern and what they're looking at for the next couple of weeks. But the main driving force is crop conditions outside of the United States boundaries. And it all started last spring with the big drop in canola acreage. That provided some underlying support to the world oilseed market. Now we're beginning to focus on the Russia and the hot heat wave that they have going on there, and the shrinking wheat supplies. Nobody has a good handle on really how bad they're getting hurt. But when you're looking at 100-degree temperatures and no rain in sight, you know the crops being hurt.
Well, those are generally fairly dry and arid areas, though they have awfully good soils. In Ukraine, do you think it's being hurt a lot? I mean, what do we hear really out of Russia and the Ukraine?
Well, you can only, you know, the wire services, you can read about anything you want to read on it. But I think the consensus, anyway, of the people that's been kind of following the wire services and trying to get a handle on it, feel that, the Soviet Union or former Soviet Union or Russia may end up with 8 million tons less of exportable wheat for the coming crop year. And if that's the case, you know, that offers opportunities for other countries to sell into that to replace that wheat.
Tell me about how that replacement happens with corn and what the relationship between wheat and corn might be on the global front.
Well, corn has its own good set of fundamentals, starting with the June report, with planted acreage coming in a couple million acres less than what the trade was wanting to tout. There are a lot of people wanting to tout 90 million. We came in 2 million less than that, a little bit more than that. That kind of laid the groundwork, even when using a fairly aggressive yield of 164 of a very snug balance sheet as you go forward, that we have to have a big yield. There's always been a lot of buzz what may or may not be happening in China when they started coming into the world market for some corn inventory here a couple months ago. That continues to be the big buzz, what they might be looking at for the coming year. So the trade as a whole is just looking at improved export demand for U.S. commodities because of the problems that has occurred outside of the U.S. boundaries. Then you combine that with a weakening dollar. The dollar has done nothing but weaken since the first part of June. I don't know how we closed here today, but I do know we broke underneath this 82 level on the dollar. That continues to, help the U.S. commodities become more competitive in the world market. And then when you shrink world inventory supplies, it is reflected in Chicago with higher commodity prices.
And the dollar is lower at this point at 81.62. Come back to the soy market for me for just a bit. You talked about the potentials there, but it's an awfully big crop. The carryover by the time we get to the end of next year's, this marketing year, is something above 300 million tons or 300 million bushel. Can that market get very bullish?
Well, if you believe that, Todd, I got a bridge in Alaska.
I didn't say I believed it. That's just the numbers.
Well, and I think that's why the markets are climbing higher here. I mean, you just look at for the month of July, and I think this is real important. Basically, November soybeans, I think, posted maybe their second highest close for the month of July, if not the highest close today. We start penetrating 990, 992, and that opens up the gates for, from a technical perspective, to a good challenge of that 1035 January high. And, you know, I think I told you a month or so ago, basically over the past 31 years, only two January highs have held in 31 years. So I think that is in play, and I think when you look at the price action, the trade doesn't believe that 300 million bushel carryover any more than a man in the moon.
Well, we'll talk with you more about it next week. How about that?
That's good.
All right. Thanks much.
Very well.
That is Dan Zwicker. He's with ADM Grain Group out of Decatur, Illinois. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report. Happens each and every Thursday afternoon. If you'd like to hear Dan again, you can do it on our website at willag.org. We post not long after we finish up with the program, about 3:15. At the same time, you can hear it on the phone at 217-333-3434. This is the Closing Market Report.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
In today's agricultural news, three major ethanol groups say EPA has the authority under existing law to approve a 12% blend of ethanol in gasoline, or E12, if it chooses, and to formally request it do so pending the ongoing testing of E15. American Coalition for Ethanol Vice President for Market Development Ron Lamberty says a few months ago EPA would not even consider an interim ethanol blend above the existing 10% mixture. Now Lamberty's group has joined with Growth Energy and the Renewable Fuels Association in formally asking EPA to endorse E12 use. EPA was supposed to decide on the use of higher blended E15 gasoline last December, but put off that decision till June to allow more Energy Department vehicle testing, and has now delayed a decision again till this fall. But Lamberty says E12, that one's a different story.
Ethanol adds 3.5% oxygen at 10%. The limit that's allowed by the EPA is 4%. Now, that would put you at somewhere over between 11 and 12, but then EPA also says they have some margin for error in there.
Lamberty says the ethanol groups argue that since EPA's already tested 4% oxygen in vehicles without exceeding Clean Air Act standards, it should allow E12 on the market. And even if EPA decides to approve E15 in certain vehicles in a couple of months,
there's still going to be some steps in between, rule writing and then, you know, back and forth about how we should enforce this. I mean, how do you make E15 only available to certain cars?
Lamberty says it may take months to write regulations, making it even more pressing to find a place to put surplus ethanol with the E10 blend wall, limiting allowable volumes. From biofuels and the technologies laid therein, let's move to Monsanto and corn technologies. Monsanto Company is one step closer to being able to sell two of its corn technologies in the European Union. The EU has authorized two corn technology combinations, the Genuity VT Double Pro and the YieldGuard VT Triple. The decisions cover the import, processing, and food and feed use of grain and processed products. The final step in the approval process is publication of the decision by the European Commission. The EU decision follows the independent scientific advice of the European Food Safety Authority. Finally, today, a food system summit has been scheduled. The Center for Food Integrity Food System Summit will be held in Chicago October the 5th and 6th. Experts there will focus discussion on current and emerging issues facing today's U.S. food system. The fifth annual summit will offer practical applications for building consumer trust and confidence in the U.S. food system. Summit attendees will be the first to see results of the 2010 Consumer Trust Survey. Deputy Ag Secretary Kathleen Merrigan, Greg Jaffe of the Center for Science in Public Interest, Richard Rogers of the Gates Foundation, and Mary Lou Quinlan of Just Ask a Woman will participate in the event. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Support comes from Stewart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stewart-peterson.com.
Well, here on the Closing Market Report, we deal with production, agriculture, and pricing commodities each and every day. In Washington, D.C., they deal with that and with how to use some of those products within the school system. That's called the Child Nutrition Act. It's a bill that's up for reauthorization right now. USDA's Susan Carter has the details.
The focus of the series is to ensure federal nutrition programs address hunger and obesity among children. Deputy Administrator for Special Nutrition Programs, Audrey Rowe.
The heart of this bill is picking up from daycare programs and taking kids all the way through high school and making their school meal environment a much healthier environment.
Rowe is talking about the reauthorization of the Child Nutrition Act.
The improving of access. We want to make sure that we expand the nutrition, healthy food service that children receive, as well as to increase participation.
Another key element to improved school nutrition are choices.
What this legislation does and what schools have started to do is introduce new things to them. My favorite story is a parent who called a school one day right after they had introduced some new fruits and vegetables and called the school and said, "Where do I find a star fruit? And what is a star fruit?" The child had been introduced to it and really liked it.
Rowe highlights this as a prime example of how children can influence the eating habits of their families.
Children impact their parents' buying habits, their behavior. They're looking for healthier food when they're at home. They want to see salads and they want to see cucumbers and tomatoes. And they don't want the pizzas that come out of the box, but they want to make healthy pizzas because that's what they do in the classroom. They're learning where their food comes from. Parents may bring it home from the grocery store, but it starts, you know, in gardens and on farms. So it's all part of helping young people make healthy choices and understand the importance of healthy diets.
The 10-year, $10 billion request will also allow for such things as
the growth of the program, the strengthening of the value of the meals, the implementation of the Institute of Medicine's recommendations, things like continuing to reduce the fat, starting to take down the sodium. The legislation allows us to regulate all that and make the school environment a much more healthy environment.
The legislation also gives Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack the authority to regulate all foods that are in schools, extending to vending machines. Another component is Farm to School, which is patterned after Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food.
One of the things that I talk to schools about, and I talk on these nutrition tours, is identifying local farmers, local producers who can provide what some of the foods that schools need. I mean, the other part of it is also helping farmers understand how to negotiate and to work with schools.
The bill would also provide for new cooking equipment.
For example, taking the fryers out of the schools and replacing them with combi ovens, which allow them to prepare food so that they're healthier, baking foods and baking potatoes and those kinds of things instead of frying.
To the hiring of such food specialists as nutritionists, in addition to making schools better buyers of food products. Changing the eating habits of children, says Rowe, will change the eating habits of their families, all for the betterment of their health. For USDA Radio, Susan Carter, Washington, D.C.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Please do visit our website. The address is willag.org. Now, with a little help from our friends at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting, in particular, Michelle Rook at WNAX in Yankton, South Dakota. She's the farm broadcaster there and also airs on WTAX out of Springfield, Illinois from time to time. We bring you a story about Mexico. She writes to us that U.S. soybeans are being incorporated into Mexican diets. through the state and federal school feeding or lunch system. And the Dr. Martha Vasquez is the director of social programs in the region around Guadalajara. Now, she says they introduced textured soy protein just a few years ago to preschool and primary school age children in Mexico.
We use texturized soy, which is great because once you hydrate it, it's just like ground chuck, like meat. And we have many recipes adapted to our Mexican culture. We can have from mole to chili to whatever presentation.
Vasquez says they teach mothers how to cook with soy in the schools, as they are the ones that actually prepare the food for the lunch program. She says the moms then take the recipes back home.
We train mothers. We teach them how to prepare soy. We have not only theory, we have practice. We help the mothers. And they come in every single day at school. And mothers also, because they know that their kids love it, they take the recipes home. They buy soy on their own, take the recipes home, and also feed their families, their husbands. And sometimes even the husbands are saying, you know, why are you giving me this? And once they taste it, they go, wow, it's so good. You know, they like it.
Vasquez says the soy products and the recipes have been well received by children, and there are many benefits to soy in the diet for kids, as well as for adults. She hopes soy is one of the answers to the growing obesity problem in Mexico.
Kids love it. We use tortillas, Mexican tortillas, which gives the children lots of fiber and calcium and so on. And combined with the soy, which is a legume, a perfect legume, we have a good amount of amino acids that we can give the children, and it's energy also. Kids need to have this breakfast program and so that their learning capabilities are enhanced. And this way we incorporate soy.
She says one of the other benefits of the texturized soy product is that it's a good protein at an economical price.
Meat is expensive, and so soy provides an alternative, which is highly nutritious. 1 kilo of texturized soy meat, once hydrated, for me it's only 4 pesos, 5 pesos. But at 1 kilo of regular ground chuck, it would cost you about 60, 70 pesos, 80. So texturized soy is so inexpensive for us.
Vasquez says soy is also being introduced to adults and being incorporated into the social feeding programs for low-income and elderly Mexicans. The number of new soy food products on the store shelves is also growing rapidly in Mexico. It's all the result of export programs funded by the U.S. Soybean Checkoff. 10 U.S. farmers from across the country heard about this effort as part of this week's United Soybean Board See for Yourself tour in Guadalajara, Mexico. Our thanks go to farm broadcaster Michelle Rook of WNAX in Yankton, South Dakota, for providing the audio from Mexico, and Martha Vasquez. In just a couple minutes, we'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast. You're listening to Illinois Public Media. It is a production of the University of Illinois.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgro seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
It's National Lasagna Day. It's also St. Martha's Day, patron saint of butlers, dietitians, cooks, innkeepers, and waitresses. On this day in agricultural history in 1796, Walter Hunt was born. He invented the first safety pin in 1849, which he called a dress pin. The pin was made out of brass wire about 8 inches long, coiled at the center and shielded at one end. He sold the rights to the pin for $400. By the way, Hunt began his inventing in his late teens with a machine to spin flax. In 1870, the first asphalt pavement was laid in the U.S. in Newark, New Jersey. In 1914, Baron Marcel Bic was born. A French inventor, he created the Bic pen in 1949. And in 1973, the Bic lighter. And in 1976, the Bic shaver. In 1977, Buffalo, New York declared this day Chicken Wing Day in honor of the famous Buffalo chicken wings created by Teresa Bellissimo in October of 1964. And in 1984, Fred Waring died. Waring provided financial backing for development of a blender to puree raw vegetables for his ulcer diet. The machine, originally introduced as the Miracle Mixer, debuted in 1937 and sold for $29.75. By 1954, the name had changed to the Waring Blender, and more than 1 million had been sold. And that's this day in agricultural history.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media, the U of I campus in Urbana-Champaign. I'm Todd Gleason. On the phone line with us, Pete Levitt, agricultural meteorologist, joins us from the East Coast in Massachusetts. Good afternoon, Pete. How are you today?
Good afternoon, Todd. I'm in good shape today.
Good deal. Let's talk a little bit about the weather forecast. Start here in the Midwest. There is some concern, I suppose, that the weather might turn not so great for the crops, but so far, so good.
Yeah, so far so good. The key to the weather as far as the crops are concerned has been all the moisture that was laid down across the western and central portions of the Corn Belt from late June right on through most of this month. And that's that high moisture profile, which has, as a matter of fact, local flooding has been a downside of it, but that's going to sustain the crop right through the month of August because the hints you or the things you're hinting at are, I think, are going to come. It looks like we're going to see much warmer temperatures when we get into about the middle third of next month, the middle third of August, and heat is going to be a problem where there has not been enough moisture. The good news is they have had the moisture in the western central Corn Belt. Where they're having the problem for the crops really is down in the Delta region where it has been dry this past month, and they're going to get some heat added on to that in August, and that's where I think you may see some crop conditions start to fail. Now, we have a saying which we talk about every year that for weather July is the month for corn for precipitation. August is the month for soybeans. So corn had its moisture in July, and now it's just got to work its way, utilize that moisture, and mature. So I think the prospects for corn are very good across most of the Midwest, even if we get hot and dry in August. However, not the case with soybeans. Soybeans is an August month, and the moisture it uses now, it will consume and put on more growth. But then if it dries out, as we expect it to do as we move into August, especially in the eastern and southern portions of the growing belt for soybeans, then I think we'll see some stress there. So that's the general picture.
And then turn your attention to the former Soviet system. I believe that probably the damage has been done at this point because that should be coming to harvest in the next 4 weeks. What do you see in the wheat?
Well, that has been a problem. They've had very hot weather and very dry weather. It hasn't been quite as hot, or the effects of it, I think, as been reported in some of the media, but I think it is a tough crop there. They're having problems with that crop. I think they're not seeing any moisture now either. I think they're going to have a much reduced yield, especially for that wheat crop, the Ukraine, and then northeastward from there up toward the Ural.
Anything else to add before I let you go for the day?
No, that's, as I say, we'll talk very quickly, the El Niño-La Niña pattern. We are going into a La Niña. That means a significant effect on the weather in the wintertime. The good news is that La Niñas or El Niños have very little effect for our main growing areas in the summertime, no matter what sign they're on.
All right. Thanks much, Pete.
My pleasure.
Pete Levitt, agricultural meteorologist, joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Thursday afternoon. If you can stay with us for the Farming World, please do. We'll talk with Steve Long. He's a professor of crop sciences and heads up the soy face experiments here on campus, looking at increased carbon dioxide and climate change impact on crop production. Otherwise, you can hear it at willag.org. This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we're joined by Professor Stephen Long. He's in crop sciences here at the U of I and researching CO2, climate change, and the impact it may or may not have on crops in the future. Professor Long, thank you for being with us. I know that you operate the Soyface experiment here on this campus and that you're looking at how carbon dioxide concentrations, particularly in the future, might change what happens in the field. The expectation, I suppose, early on, within the last 20 years, is that as CO2 rises, that the crops would do better because, of course, they use carbon dioxide. Is that right?
Yes, the expectation. We have expectations both from laboratory studies and from theory that rising carbon dioxide levels should stimulate the yields of crops.
And is that still the view a couple of decades after this idea was first put forward?
Well, now that we have experiments where we can actually elevate the carbon dioxide level in a very controlled way in a farmer's field, we're not seeing those stimulations in the field. And that is of concern because that stimulation is one of the factors which is expected to offset the more damaging aspects of climate change in considering global food production.
Just for clarification purpose then, as forests around the globe are cut down, I'm thinking of the Amazon jungle particularly, if that should happen and has happened in the past, those forests no longer are using up carbon dioxide, and that makes higher CO2 levels available across the planet. And the idea then potentially was that that available CO2, while dangerous in some respects, would give crops, plants, other plants, a leg up on production.
Yes. There are two reasons for that. One is crops we call C3 crops, which include wheat, rice, and soybean, have this process called photorespiration, which basically burns away some of the carbon that has recently been fixed by the plant, on average about 30%. Now, CO2 actually, rising CO2 inhibits this photorespiration, and that's the theory. And if we do this in a controlled environment in the laboratory, we see that response. So the expectation for a long time was, well, this rising CO2 would increase the yield of those crops. There is a second factor as well, that as there's more CO2 available, the plant has to lose less water to obtain that carbon dioxide. And again, in the laboratory, that appears to benefit all plants. But as so often is the case, once we take the theory to the farmer's field, we don't always see the same response. And of course, that now raises more research questions.
Is that to say then that the fundamental theory that higher levels of CO2 will help us to feed ourselves in the future is not true?
I wouldn't say it's not true at all, but we're only seeing, in these large field-scale experiments, we're only seeing with soybean and wheat and rice, we're only seeing about half of the response that was expected, and half the response that has been used in predictions of future food supply.
It's a very complicated field, it seems, and one that still has a lot of work to be done. There are ideas that respiration either goes up or goes down, depending on what's happening with the CO2?
Yes. And again, I think it's perhaps been, now that we have better techniques for looking at respiration, the evidence really is for increased respiration, certainly not decreased.
Can you draw any conclusions or silver linings from the rising CO2 levels?
Well, I'd say it's certainly not the silver lining we were expecting. On the other hand, if we can show that plants can do this in the laboratory, then we really need to understand, well, why isn't this happening in the field? Are there factors we could be selecting for genetically that would overcome this so that we would get the theoretical gain? what we have found here with our work on soybean is that there is variability between cultivars. So it appears there must be some genes which do favour this response. So you're right, the silver lining's not at least as easily obtained as we thought, but this isn't without hope.
I hope you don't mind if I ask you a bit of a personal question. There's lots of debate around the globe about climate change on both sides, especially within the science community. I wonder if you feel like an embattled figure to some extent, or that if science doesn't quite get understood on the journalist side or from the public side, that it's not really as black and white as we'd all like it to be, and that there are variabilities that, well, science either hasn't discovered or can't take into account just yet.
Well, this is an extremely complex issue. You know, as we know, just with the climate science area, you know, we're obviously looking at a very, you know, one of the most complex systems there is, the climate and atmosphere interacting with the vegetation. There are a lot of unknowns in all of that. I mean, I have no doubt that the basics are correct, though, that the climate is changing. And, of course, we know very precisely that the CO2 level of the world is rising day by day. We know, too, from our analyses that our crops are already not adapted to today's conditions. They're adapted to conditions of the past in terms of the atmosphere. So there are very clear issues there. And I'd say, we're right in the middle of the Corn Belt here, where a lot of people depend on their crops for their livelihood and people working around them. And certainly in that community, there is concern about what is happening and what can be done about it. So, you know, the perspectives may differ from different locations.
Does it frustrate you that people want definitive answers so quickly, so early in this process? And while you suggest that we know definitively some of the answers, that certainly we may not know all of them at this point?
Well, I mean, that may be part of the problem, that people have wanted very clear answers, which, particularly without the investment in the science, is very difficult to deliver. I mean, it's taken really, 2001 was where our large field scale experiment started. So this was the first one to look at corn and soybean anywhere in the world, at a farm scale. And it really seems, we know from, for example, industry trials of herbicides and other chemicals, that these have to be done at a farm scale. You can get brilliant results in the lab. The company takes it to the field and it doesn't work. So we shouldn't perhaps be too surprised that, what we devise in the lab and in theory doesn't always work in the field. And indeed, science typically is about, well, you test it in the real world and then if the answer is slightly different, you need to come back to the lab and look at what is missing in that information.
So if I can ask for something a bit definitive, how is it that you account for the lab experiments that suggest that CO2, extra CO2, is good for plants, but in the field it may not show up?
The field situation is very different. If you take, a controlled environment or a controlled greenhouse, temperatures do not change very much. The moisture and humidity are controlled. When you're in the field, for example, and, we have here in central Illinois, we have some of the best growing conditions in the world. Temperature will vary 15 degrees Celsius over the course of a day, maybe more. The humidity may go from sort of a 100% relative humidity to 50%. And of course, light is changing all the time, fluctuating. Plants behave somewhat differently in a fluctuating environment. And we do know a lot less about that. But so there are a number of other factors which may change it. Of course, the rooting environment is very different when you're in a farmer's field to in pots in the laboratory or controlled environments.
So that fluctuating environment, that environment that your soy face experiment is in the midst of in a field here in central Illinois, is one of the ways or one of the reasons that explains the difference between laboratory results and field results.
Yes, I think that may be one of the factors. But, you know, as I said earlier, I think what we now need to do is we do know that cultivars differ in their response. So that means there are some aspects of the genetics which favor a response. There may be some genes which favor the response. So really what we need to be able to do now is at the field level, identify those genes, identify markers close to them so that breeders can then select for this responsiveness to CO2.
So that is to say, soybean breeders, corn breeders, plant breeders of all types should look for plants that might respond more favorably to CO2, and that's one of the things that you've seen as a result of the soy face experiments?
Well, I think we've, from, and unfortunately around the world, there have been a very limited number of these field experiments done. So we're working with very limited information, but what we have seen is that one line of the species will respond more than another one. So that does give us a handle. If we can then say, okay, what are the genes that are allowing this plant to do better than this one? Then we've got something that breeders can start to use. And we've seen that's true with wheat, with rice, with soybean, even with corn. So there are, globally, they're the four biggest crops in terms of food production.
Professor Long, thank you so much for taking the time with us today. That's Stephen Long. He's a professor at the University of Illinois in crop sciences and is a primary in the soy face experiment. Soy face, by the way, stands for soybean free air concentration enrichment. It's an innovative facility for growing crops under production field conditions in an atmosphere that has higher levels of carbon dioxide and ozone, higher temperature, and sometimes altered soil water availability. Soyface was designed to discover the effects of atmospheric change on the agronomy and production of Midwestern crops, as well as to find solutions that will lead to crops better adapted to this future. It's a unique facility and highly interdisciplinary, according to the Soyface webpage, which is at soyface.illinois.edu. And the research teams there work to answer several questions. These include, what yield and quality changes will result with rising CO2, temperature, drought stress, and ozone? What genotypes or genes may be exploited to increase yield and maintain quality under those changed atmospheric conditions? What system changes will increase yields and maintain quality under that atmosphere? Will soil quality degrade, and how can that be alleviated? Will rates of soil carbon deposition be increased, and what value might that have in terms of carbon credits? And finally, how will changes in CO2, temperature, and drought stress and ozone impact insect and pathogens? It's all at the Soyface Experiment here in Urbana-Champaign. You can visit the Soyface website again at soyface.illinois.edu. You're listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Recapping again the numbers from the CME Group and the Kansas City Board of Trade in Chicago on this Thursday afternoon. Futures finished the hard red winter wheat in Kansas City at $6.46 and a quarter for the September contract, 15.5 cents the gain for the day there. September in Chicago for the soft red at $6.27 and a half, up 12 cents. Corn pit was higher. September contract up 3 at $3.79 and a quarter. December 3.93 and 3 quarters up 3. The March at $4.06 and a half up 3. And July of next year at $4.20 and 3 quarters up 2 and 1 quarter. Distillers dry grains up $10 at $106.90 a ton. And the crude oil at $78.36 a barrel, up $1.37. Soy complex, August beans, $10.26 and 3 quarters up 16 and a quarter. The November futures at $9.88, up a dime. And the January's at 9.95 and a half, up 8 3/4. Meal at 305.40, up 370. Bean oil at 39.27, up 43. August live cattle futures 91.85. They were down 92.5 cents. The August feeders for the day at 113.72 and a half, down 80 cents. And the lean hog futures in Chicago at the CME Group settled at $84.85. $1.47.5, 100 weight higher. You, of course, have been listening to the Closing Market Report, Illinois Public Media, and the Farming World. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions for our programming, please don't hesitate to write us an email. The address is willagstaff@illinois.edu. That's willagstaff@illinois.edu. Or you can call 217-333-1070 and ask for me, Todd Gleason, or for Dave Dickey. It's all part of the agricultural programming from Illinois Public Media. You're listening to The Farming World from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. In the second part of our program today, we'll talk with David Headley. He is a soy ambassador for the state of Illinois. Mr. Headley, thanks for joining me. Tell me, please, what is a soybean ambassador?
The Soy Ambassador Program is a program that gives emerging leaders the opportunity to gain expertise, industry exposure, and a global perspective that is critical in becoming a knowledgeable and effective future board member of the Illinois Soybean Association. The whole entire premise of the Soy Ambassador Program is for folks that are young soybean farmers to learn about the industry so later on they can be a board member. Those that work in the soybean industry, however, since they're not soybean farmers, cannot be elected to the board, but they give leadership opportunities for future involvement in the soybean industry, whether it's working at ADM, Cargill, or working with the American Soybean Association or some other type of entity that promotes soybeans both domestically and internationally. The Illinois Soybean Association sponsors this program and believes that it's an investment in the leadership development that will benefit in the organization's future. Another key aspect of this is that the Illinois Soybean Association pays all out-of-pocket expenses, so there's no financial burden for anybody that wants to apply. There's no, if you have to pay for something out of the pocket when you're on any of the events, you just fill out an expense report and the Soybean Association reimburses you for the expense. And the application deadline is rapidly approaching. It's December 16th, 2010. And I can give more information about how they can apply to it. If you want to give me, I can give that now or I can give that later.
Okay, well, it looks to me like the way they apply is they do that online and they can download the application from illsoy.org. And it's actually on the front page, so it's pretty easy to find.
Yes, it is. It's on the front page. It is. Double click on it and the application page comes right up there. And as soon as they're done, they submit it and it goes right to the office.
So are you a soy ambassador then? Is this correct, right?
That is correct.
You're already in the program, and how long have you been in the program?
We've been in the program for a year and a half now. Our 2 years ends this November. We have our last event and the first event for the new class is the Illinois Commodity Classic that's in Bloomington this year in November.
What have you learned?
I've learned that there's a lot that Illinois soybeans reach well beyond the border of the state of Illinois. And one of the key things that I've learned that stands out in my mind is when we went to Brazil, how the Brazilian farmers kept looking at their iPhones and their other Blackberries on a regular basis. And I got interested. I was like, why are you looking at your thing? They're like, we're checking the Chicago Board of Trade because if the soybeans stay above $9 a bushel, we'll make a profit. If they go below $9 a bushel, we don't make a profit, so we're constantly checking to make sure that they're above $9 a bushel.
Sounds familiar. What else did you do? Where have you traveled?
We've traveled to internationally. We went to Brazil because the Illinois Soybean Association has an exchange program with Mato Grosso State in Brazil, which is by the Amazon, and Mato Grosso State is larger than Oklahoma, Texas, and Louisiana combined. So just to give you a perspective on how big we're talking about here. And they only use 7 to 9% of their land to grow soybeans because of the Amazon biome and the regulations they have to use because of the Amazon forest. So that's a very it was a very cultural experience when we were there. But when we were there in this particular area, they were harvesting beans when we were there in January, and when we were standing, it was soybean fields to the left, to the right, to the front, and the back of us. You couldn't see anything else but soybean fields. It's a very large chunk of land they have down there that they're farming beans. And the program is that Illinois Soybean Association goes down usually in January. And then during their winter time, they come up here and learn about how we do things. And it's a great program that, we have together. But also some of the other events that we did was we went to Washington, D.C. To speak with our legislative folks, both our senators and a few representatives when we were in Washington, D.C. We also went to St. Louis to Soy Leadership School that's held every year in January. We also attended an ISA board meeting. We also attended WISH Midwest Workshop, which is the World Soy and Human Health Protein Workshop, where industry experts come in from all over the world and talk about soy as a protein source and how it's being used in developing countries as a food source to combat malnutrition. And there's also an annual research tour that's at U of I and SIU that's coming up next week that we will be attending. But we also attended that last year. And there's the Into Soy course, which is the international soy course that's held at U of I campus at the International Soybean Research Laboratory, where folks from all over the world come to learn about soy applications in baking, meat products, and other ways that you can use soy in products. And I think this year there were folks from 30 to 40 different countries that were there talking about how they use soy on a regular basis in their world. And we also went to USEC, which is the United States Soybean Export Council. They have an international strategic marketing conference every year in St. Louis, and we were part of that to see how soybeans are marketed in different countries around the world.
David, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
That's David Headley. He's a soy ambassador for the Illinois Soybean Association. If you're 21 years of age or older or know somebody that might be interested in becoming a soybean ambassador, you can visit them online and get the application for download at www.ilsoy.org. The Soy Ambassador Program is listed on the front page. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.